All right. Hey, folks. Thanks for tuning in to the BAMF podcast. I'm your host, Mike Lafferty. And today we're talking about World War II, the Good War, and the way it's shown up in various forms of media, games, since this is a gaming podcast, TV, movies, etc. And we've got a illustrious panel of RPG talent with us tonight, starting with Mr. Janus. Sorry, I said Janus instead of Jason. What's wrong with me? Jason Morningstar from Bullet Bullet Games. How you doing, sir?
I'm doing well, thanks.
And Jason, you probably know from Fiasco, and he just recently kickstarted Night Witches, which could you give us just a quick blurb on that, Jason?
Sure, yeah. In Night Witches, you play members of the 588th Night Bomber Regiment, which was a Soviet regiment that was composed entirely of women, and they fought on the Eastern Front and had many exciting adventures. So sort of the intersection of this total brutal war on the Eastern Front and sort of with a feminist slant. So that's Night Witches.
Oh, cool. And we'll get into more of that later, but that sounds really interesting.
That's very cool. I have to look this up on Wikipedia when we're done.
Check it out. It's a good story.
And I presume that your description of this is all historical, that there actually was this unit?
Yeah, absolutely. There were actually three. The 588th was the one that had no men in it at all. The other two had a few support personnel that were male. And there's a really interesting story behind how they were formed and their service record and so forth. But yeah, they're real.
That's great.
And just to tie to comic books, because we touch on that sometimes, Garth Ennis wrote a comic about the Night Witches back in, I want to say, 2009 in his Battlefields series for Dynamite.
He did indeed.
Yeah, so that's kind of cool. Also with us today is Walt Rebilliard.
I am not a female Russian sniper.
How do you want me to respond to that?
We're talking about World War II and females doing cool things and women doing cool things in World War II from the Russian side. They also had a heavy presence in some of the sniper regiments.
Okay, I did not know that. That's pretty cool. And we have Mr. Chris McLaughlin from Green Ronin. How you doing, Chris?
I'm great. I'm in my Civil War reenacting costume, so I sort of feel like I came to the wrong podcast, but I'm going to try to muddle through.
Can we say you're a time traveler?
Oh, yeah, I like that. Let's go with that.
All right.
Which side are you on, Chris?
Not too many blue units here in Virginia.
Yeah. Gotcha, okay.
You can tell by his accent.
And Mr. Chuck Rice is here as well.
Hi.
Hey, Chuck, how you doing?
I'm good.
You're a man of few words tonight.
just wait. I'm getting warmed up.
All right. Chuck, you did a World War II gaming project back at RPG Objects, didn't you?
Yeah, and a lot of World War II super stuff when I was at Vigilance Press. World War II.
Involved in with that stuff. Yeah, it's coming back.
Yeah, I am the son of a World War II veteran, so that is a time period that's always had a lot of interest for me.
Okay, cool. And rounding out our panel is Professor Jason Chandro. How you doing, Jason?
I'm well, thanks.
All right. And well, hey, I'm at a loss for where exactly to start now that I've introduced everybody. So, Jason, we were talking to you earlier about your game. Could you kind of go, give us a little more, in depth on what motivated you to, pick this particular subject? I know you've kind of touched on this before with, was it the Grey Legions, the Child Resistance Fighters in World War II in Warsaw?
Yeah, Grey Ranks.
Grey Ranks, sorry.
So I'm interested in this particular war and sort of ways to get into it that are perhaps a little more obscure to a Western audience. So yeah, Grey Ranks was about partisans during the Warsaw Uprising in 1944 that came out of the Boy Scouts and Girl Guides. So you play 14, 15, 16, 17-year-olds who, were right there on the front lines in the uprising, which is a pretty interesting lens to look at the war through. And then Night Witches, as I said earlier, you're playing essentially bomber pilots, but the sort of the kicker is that these women were given 20-year-old equipment, so they say night bombers, they were really flying agricultural biplanes and, these canvas and wood planes that were incredibly vulnerable to both ground fire and the German aircraft. So they were flying really dangerous missions at really low altitudes in obsolete airplanes, which, you know, in itself takes a lot of courage, I suspect. And, you know, that's a really compelling hook. And then when you find out that it was a regiment that from the major in charge all the way down to the lowliest mechanic armorer was all women, and that they were highly decorated and really effective throughout the war. They flew 1,200 sorties over the course of the war. They were flying, or 1,200 missions, rather, and each mission was maybe 10 sorties because they were right behind the front lines, so they would go drop bombs, come back, and do that 10 times a night. It's just an incredible story. And, of course, they're dealing with endemic sexism in the Red Army. These units were put together because Stalin said so, basically, because he'd been persuaded by a female pilot who was also a celebrity in the 30s named Marina Raskova, who recognized the need for this after the beginning of the war when huge portions of the Russian Air Force were wiped out in the first month of combat. And they had all these women who had trained in the 30s to be pilots and pilot instructors for civil aviation. And so she went to her good friend Stalin and said, you really should set up some regiments to do this. And he agreed. And, you know, what he said goes, went. And so they put these regiments together, but they weren't particularly well supported, particularly the 588. But the other two were a day bomber regiment and a fighter regiment that were a little better supported. But so it's a cool story. There's all kinds of there's really no historical precedent for it, but they got into all kinds of really interesting situations, and the game follows them across the entire war. If you play it as a campaign, you can start in training and end with them bombing Berlin. And so, like, you see the entire scope of the war on the Eastern Front through these women's eyes.
Wow, that's really awesome. And I've read your Kickstarter page. I like the fact that you're designing sessions to be, you know, like a two-hour session.
Because right, yeah.
That's a sweet spot for, you know, having fun at the gaming table and avoiding fatigue and, you know, attention drift.
Yeah, I agree. And that's what I have. You know, at my local crew, we play for 2 hours. That's all we get. So all of my design work kind of bends around that benchmark. And you could obviously play longer if you had it. But if you've only got a couple hours, you can still have a really quality play experience.
Okay. Now, you're using a heavily modified version of the Apocalypse World engine?
Yeah. I started with Vincent Baker's game, Apocalypse World, and got his permission to sort of hack it to do what it needs to do for Night Witches. So it's very, very modified. It's not like Apocalypse World anymore, but the bones are still there. So if you like that mechanic and sort of the way that game it forms a feedback loop between the fiction and the mechanics, then you'll probably like Night Witches too.
Cool. Just out of curiosity, I mean, it sounds like you have great interest in World War II. Are you mainly, you know, or do you mainly read novels about World War II? You watch documentaries or any other kind of other media you turn to for inspiration?
You know, I read a lot of nonfiction, so I don't read very many fictional accounts of the war. And I watch movies. You know, I'll watch fictional movies and then documentaries. But yeah, so most of my reading is nonfiction.
Jason, is there a book on the Night Witches, like a definitive one that you would recommend that I can start with?
Yeah, absolutely. The book that I would recommend is by a woman named Anne Noggle, N-O-G-G-L-E, and it's called A Dance with Death. And Anne Noggle went and interviewed a bunch of these women in the 80s, and her account is great. It's all first-person accounts from the people who were in the regiment and served and fought, and it's really good. Her book is good. There's another woman named Kazimira Kossum who has written two books about them that are both great. So that's where I'd start for sure.
I'll put a link to that in the show notes. And Jason Tonder, I'm popping an Amazon link in the chat window for you.
Sweet. Thanks.
Yeah, no worries. So, well, yeah, it's one of those, as you said, kind of obscure areas. It doesn't get, you know, as much attention as it should. But there's kind of a lot of little lost stories like that in World War II. You know, as you touched on with the child resistance fighters, you know, in Poland. And I know when I was in Norway, I hadn't realized how active the resistance was before. You know, the one museum in Oslo that's free that you always go to as a tourist is the Resistance Museum. And
you're cool, yeah.
And there's a lot of stories you just never heard of. You know, guys, you know, out in cabins in the, you know, Arctic Circle sniping at Germans and, you know, getting away on cross-country skis and stuff.
There's a cool movie called The Last Lieutenant. That's a Norwegian film from 1993. That's about the Norwegian resistance and capitulation. It's super good.
Oh, cool. I'll check that one out. Do you have a favorite World War II movie, Jason?
Jason, me?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, you.
I do. My favorite World War II movie is called Come and See, Idi i Smotri. It's a movie about partisans in Belarusia. It's the director's Ellen Klimov. It's from 1985, and it is unbelievable. I've never seen anything like it. It's a film that just burns with this incandescent rage. It really gives you a feeling for why the war became so intense and personal on the Eastern Front. And it's beautifully filmed and just harrowing. It's hard to watch, but really good. It's by far my favorite World War II movie.
What was the title of that one again?
In English, it's Come and See.
Okay.
Come and See.
I haven't heard that one before. I'll have to check it out. Well, hey, since I was teasing Jason Tundra there without meaning to, what's your favorite World War II movie or comic book or novel?
Oh, shit. That's a tough question.
You can say Roy Thomas' Invaders if you like.
Well, no, I mean, you know, see, I sort of thought we were going to be talking, like, I was thinking about games and stuff, and so.
No, but
and comics, and so my head is kind of in that Roy Thomas and, you know, like the James Robinson's wonderful Golden Age book that sort of rebooted Starman and all those things. But I also have a fondness for, like, the first World War II gaming product I ever owned was Golden Age of Champions, which told me a lot about the setting and about, like, gaming concerns, you know, like, how do you keep your character from being sent off in the draft? And how do you get a 4F rating and so on? Which I found really practical and useful. And there's been so many other great World War II role-playing products, including Chris's, by the way, which I have right here on my shelf.
Oh, thank you.
And for those who aren't in Jason's office right now, he's talking about Golden Age Freedom City.
Yeah.
Speak for yourself. I'm watching him through his webcam right now.
Is that a permanent charge? Or? That's okay. Don't tell me. I'm not knowing. Cool.
But I am looking forward. I guess it's not. It's, you know, if I have to pick purely like fantasy World War II movies, not at all the cool, intense film like Come and See, but something which is, I guess, more like, I don't know, it's almost like World War II nostalgia pictures. Probably I'm a big fan of the old Rocketeer. You know, the original Rocketeer film with what's his name?
Jennifer Connelly and the guy that no one cared about.
Yeah, the guy, him. Which is so unfair because he's a total D&D nerd and he was
the proto Ryan Reynolds. You know, he's in it, but who cares?
I certainly know who he is because he runs this great like live theater fantasy adventure, epic fantasy theater show in L.A.
Billy Campbell.
Yeah, Bill Campbell, that's right. And he's just a really great guy. He's actually one of us. He's one of our gamer tribe, so we should really be cool to him.
Sure, I'm just saying every man at least that you talk to is like, oh, yeah, Jennifer Connelly was great in that movie.
Yeah.
Who else was in it?
Timothy Dalton.
Yeah, Tim Dalton, yeah. So films like that, but you know, I don't claim any of the sort of clout that all you guys do. You guys are all like way more knowledgeable on this topic than me. Why did you have to pick me to start with, Mike? I know.
Because I said, Jason, what's your favorite movie? I thought maybe I was disappointing you when I didn't ask for your answer. I was trying to be polite.
No, you're not here to talk to me. You're here to talk to Morningstar.
Come on. I'm actually interested in what you guys have to say about this. I'm interested in your favorite films.
Well, you know who's big into movies is Chris McLaughlin.
Oh, indeed. Yes.
Chris, do you have a favorite World War II movie? Or?
Well, I do. I, you know, history is, you know, there's a sort of that top-down view of history and then the bottom-up view of history. And I think it's valuable to study both ends of it. And I sort of have a film from each side of that. because my favorite top-down World War II film will always be Patton, because it's just such a fascinating character study. And it's probably maybe the last film we're ever going to get on a major historical figure where it isn't, this is what the filmmaker wants this person desperately to be. I mean, right. It's a completely balanced portrayal of him. I mean, they still had Omar Bradley alive to consult on the film. I mean, Patton still had powerful friends still alive that knew him well. So
it's certainly an iconic film. I remember as a kid watching that opening shot with the huge flag and him walking in front of it.
Mm-hmm. That's an amazing opening.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I mean, it's just a great film on its own merits, but just I don't think as a historian you're ever going to get that balanced portrayal of a figure again. And from the bottom up point of view, history. I know the trendy choice would be Saving Private Ryan, and really the first 20 minutes of that are incredible. But then it kind of goes, you know, it gets a little Spielberg-y for me. It never loses me. I still think it's a fantastic film. But, you know, after about that 20-minute mark, it stops being about the war and it starts being about Steven Spielberg. Now, for me, the best bottom-up film will always be Sam Fuller's The Big Red One.
Oh, with Mark Hamill.
Yes.
Yeah, that's a great movie.
And Lee Marvin. Yes. Yeah, now that's I mean, even within the confines of a different era of filmmaking, it's one of the more uncompromising and I think truthful views of what an actual infantryman went through during World War II, at least from the American perspective. Obviously, you know, I don't know if anybody will, at least for American tastes, I don't know if anybody will be able to stop the Clint Eastwood films they made to give you the Japanese point of view. And I understand there are great films made about the Russian experience by Russians. Of course, they're in Russian, so we don't care. America. Yeah. You know, yeah, but at least as far as the American point of view and what we went through, I don't know if they'll ever top The Big Red One, simply because Sam Fuller was there. And I don't know if you could ever top a guy who was actually there's perspective on it all. So those are two great films, World War II films, I don't think will ever be surpassed, quite frankly.
Okay, fair enough. When you were writing Golden Age, you know, 10 years ago, or I guess
yes.
You were writing it 12 years ago for Freedom.
Yes.
For inspiration, I'm guessing you don't watch The Big Red One, writing that book.
No. Actually, I wanted to keep the actual history of it to I didn't want it to take over the book, because real history versus the history the comic books were giving you are two very, 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 very different things.
I think this is a danger. I think you did the right thing, Chris, because I think one of the dangers in World War II gaming products is you end up spending a quarter of the book on this week-by-week timeline of World War II.
Yeah.
And it's cool, and it gives a bunch of plot scenarios, and it gives a whole scale. But it's also 25 pages.
Yes.
Yeah.
Absolutely. There's also the risk of history panic. You know, people see that, and then they freeze up players.
Yeah. Yeah, now I did want to include, I mean, I wanted to have like a really, you know, hardcore history campaign there as an option, but there was no way in the world I was going to write a worthy book about World War II and still have it be a decent comic book superhero gaming supplement kind of thing. So I think I breezed through the war in like a page and a half. I don't know if I actually did much more than, the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor, then Hiroshima and parades. but I tried to do a little more than that. But you know, I mean, I think I wound up cutting twice as much as I actually wrote for that section.
Well, those resources are out there, you know.
Yeah.
But I think if somebody needs to get the detailed overview of the war, I know a place where you could find that pretty easily.
Oh, absolutely. And I repeated several times, you know, there are actual history books that will do a much better job than what I'm doing, but here's something to get you started. So it was mostly just catching up on old, really obscure Golden Age comics, you know, because I knew my early DC, my early Marvels, but having to track down, you know, like the Fox Features stuff, the early Blue Beetles and the people that are now like thoroughly public domain, like the Black Terror. You know, that's where I did most of my work.
Okay, cool. And that reminds me, you're probably not reading Multiversity, are you?
Oh, yeah, I'm absolutely reading Multiversity.
Did you see this last episode?
I read Americana last night, yeah.
Yeah, I read it last night too. I'm not quite sure. I'll have to read it two more times before I understand all the various plot lines.
Yeah, it took me about three reads too.
Wait, I'm a married man now, so and I got a kid, so I can't drop acid the way I usually do before we learn how parent forms.
I actually found it fairly. I found it pretty easy to understand, like on the second read. Like the first time, I was just. I was trying to look for tricks. I was like, wait a minute. Is this whole page supposed to be read backwards? Because that's the kind of shit Morrison would pull, you know?
There were a couple times I actually was unhappy that I was reading on Comixology because I was like, he really wants me to do something funny with the page right now, doesn't he?
Yeah, you really want to, for that, especially for the two-page spread, it's like a 16-panel grid where he's,
wow.
he's got two pages that open up. And it's 16 panel grid, and he's depicting three different times in the same place. So you've got like the question looking into the past, like he's like at the scene of a crime, and as he's looking around, we see the woman who's gonna get killed and having a conversation with somebody. And then in between those two moments, there's the actual murder. And all of these actions are shown in sort of alternating panels around the page.
Well, now my head hurts.
Yeah, you almost feel like he sent a copy of that book to Alan Moore when he was done with Big F.U. and it puts him out on top. I just mentioned it because the Blue Beetle, the original Blue Beetle, shows up and kind of shows up in there.
Oh yeah, Blue Beetle. All the Charlton heroes are there.
Yeah,
Beetle and Peacemaker.
Yeah,
whatever it is.
Yeah. Well, to get back on track to World War II.
Right.
There's kind of this weird divide. I know we had our podcast about Captain America movie. We kind of touched on it because, you know, it's Americans really love the mythology of the Good War. And that's why Harrison Ford punches Nazis in all those Indiana Jones movies. And it's, there's something very compelling about that to us. That's why that's why most of your pulp adventures, even RPGs, involve, punching Nazis in one variation or another.
Mike, can I expand on your point for a second?
Yeah, yeah.
One thing I did learn from writing Golden Age is everybody loves their part of the Good War. You know, every country everywhere celebrates whatever they pitched in on World War II. Even Germany talks about the anti-Hitler resistance and the Valkyrie plot and things like that. Everybody finds something about World War II to be proud of. In fact, one of the nastiest criticisms I got about Golden Age was somebody posted on RPGNet, "This is the most appalling book I've ever read because it completely omits Finland's contributions to the war."
Nice.
Well. So apparently I go to Finland, I'm a dead man. Apparently, I'm like a national enemy over there.
It's like the World War II version of every character is someone's favorite character.
There you go.
Yeah.
And don't keep pissing off the Finns like that, okay, guys? That's not good confirm for that. But I hear your point, Chris. But I mean, there is a stark difference from, let's say, like what Jason's doing with Night Witches, and then the middle 20 minutes of Captain America, where it's him and the Howling Commandos running around, blasting up Hydra bases. I'm not fully comfortable. I mean, I love Captain America, and that's my favorite part of that movie. At the same time, I'm kind of uncomfortable with it because it almost seems like it's making something light entertainment that shouldn't be.
Yeah, it's glorification of war.
Just something that's interesting in preparation for this discussion, I went and looked at a bunch of World War II films. Actually, I went to the Wikipedia page called Films About World War II, and I was struck by how many comedies there were and where those comedies fell on the timeline. Starting about 1955, you started to see tons and tons of comedies, particularly in Great Britain, where they were lampooning some aspect of the war or their own soldiers or whatever. And I was struck by that because it seems from this remove, that seems totally out of place. But, I guess there's a place for escapism. And as long as, you're approaching it with that attitude, I don't think there's anything wrong with it.
Well, I mean,
if you regard the war as something that was ultimately a good thing, I hope we're not here to argue that the wrong side won or anything like that. Because if we are, I'm totally out of here. But
you're only saying that because you're in your Civil War uniform.
Well, I'll say this much: being a Confederate reenactor, it's a lot like being a Cubs fan, only with a lot more running. But if we accept the right side won and that winning World War II was a good thing, then you have to sort of backwardly accept all the terrible things that had to be done to get to that ultimate victory. And when you're left with when the victory has sort of faded from memory and you're left with the terrible things, human beings have to cope with that somehow. And obviously some people went to pieces over that. I mean, back when it was called shell shock, before we came up with the PTSD label for it and actually started giving a crap about those guys. And, you know, we just told them to suck it up and get over with it. You know, I mean, you either give into despair or you find some way to cope with it. And if you can look back and sort of ramp up the heroism retroactively, or maybe even find a way to laugh at it. I mean, that's just coping. That's just human beings trying to cope with something that they otherwise would break them.
That's a good point.
Thank you.
And if you can look at also the that a lot of the comic writers from back in the day were of Jewish descent and had to live through this horrible time, it could be a way to, you know, tell the public, you know, yeah, there are horrible things that have to be done in war, and you know, we, none of us want to do it. Nobody wants to, you know, nobody wants to be the first one to step up and throw the first punch or load the first magazine. But you look at how it was portrayed in the comics back then, and even like some of the heroes that were born out of that time, they weren't saying that we're celebrating war. They were saying that, you know, we're celebrating the fact that somebody stepped forward. You know,
Jim Steranko in his History of Comics, he said Captain America was the character that gave superhero comics a reason to exist. and what he meant by that was, of course, you know, Captain America was a symbolic representation of America punching Hitler in the face. and that comic came out in March of 1941. And it's no accident that, you know, Jack Kirby was a Jewish kid whose family was from Eastern Europe. I mean, the America as a nation may have been reluctant to enter the war, but Jack Kirby knew exactly what America should be doing, you know, punching Hitler in the face. and he used superhero comics as a propaganda tool to help influence the country in the way that he thought it ought to be going. Superhero comics in World War II are absolutely like twins, Siamese twins. Sorry, that was my dog.
did she just blow up?
What dog do you have, Jason?
What's that?
What kind of dog do you have?
Tess is a boxer, and she's very excitable, and she sees something outside on the street. It's probably a cat.
Oh, I thought she sneezed or something.
No, she is now running back and forth, jumping up to the window, and then running back out again. It's just dog shit.
My kid does that, too.
Well, my dog's not going to ask to borrow the car.
If I could teach my kid to poop outside, Well, hey, Chuck, you've been pretty quiet this whole time, man. I know you have some thoughts on this subject, as much as you've written about World War II.
I would just point out, World War II humor does not begin in the 50s. I mean, it soldiers were, like in the Italian campaign, there were those great kind of buddy humor comic strips.
Bill
Maudlin, yeah. You know, and he was there. So I think you can't enshrine it. You know, and that's kind of where we're moving toward, not just with regards to World War II and it being the quote unquote good war, but we're kind of moving toward it in the military overall, right? You can't call yourself a soldier because you're just a football player. And in fact, in the past, it wasn't like that. You know,
Well, what are you referencing when you say that? I think I'm not quite sure I follow what you're saying.
We've gotten just way too damn touchy about it, and we've gotten too touchy about many things, I suppose. But when you look at World War II, the people who were there, they knew that it was an often absurd situation and a terrible one and an amazingly uplifting one at times.
I think what Chuck's trying to get at about the football soldier thing is this, the fact that we have put every soldier on a pedestal. Like, there are no ordinary soldiers anymore, because every soldier is a hero. And every Michael Bay movie that glorifies the military is kind of part of this cultural movement that I think Chuck is pointing at. I don't know, maybe I'm wrong.
No, you are right. And of course, you know, that doesn't mean we shouldn't.
Yes, exactly. And the fact that we have
respect to soldiers. I was raised by retired command sergeant major. So, you know,
the fact that we have to even put up a disclaimer that's saying just because I don't think every soldier is a hero doesn't mean that I'm disrespecting the troops. The fact that we even have to say that is kind of going some way towards proving your point.
Well, yeah. When you look at the military, you got to look at it as a microcosm of society. You're going to have those who excel and who are, you know, the rock stars. And those are the guys that put in all that hard work and do the right thing, but then also have kind of the right connections. And then you have the guys that are the total other end of the spectrum. You have criminals, you have drug dealers, you have people who want to cheat the system. I mean, I can't tell you how many times I was sitting inside of, you know, inside of an armory, and somebody said, hey, do you have your Article 32 card on you? And I'm like, no, who are you reading rights to? And they're like, oh, some private just got back from basic training, got baked, and then pissed hot on your analysis. So we got to read him his rights, and he's going to get busted. You know, I mean, so you got, you know, by the same token, you have other privates who come out of basic training. They make the right connections. They do the right things. And, you know, they end up winning prestigious awards and competitions and going on to special training. So if you look at the military as a microcosm for society, you definitely have your heroes. But the other side of that is true as well. You definitely have your dirtbags who really shouldn't be in uniform. And that a lot of that is ascribed to when they did the surge at certain times throughout the military, like when they did the draft during Vietnam and before. They did the huge surge during 2003 to about 2007. And that's, you know, when you start getting this huge influx and you lower your standards to get more people in.
Bringing people who have no business being there.
Yeah, exactly. That's when you start having those difficulties, because now you're just trying to stuff numbers into boots rather than the right people in the right place for the right job.
And of course, soldiers are just people. One of the, I will never forget, I was at MacDill with my dad, and I was I was just a kid, but I remember being kind of bowled over. There was a young man, like, to me at my age at that time, I wasn't even in high school. This guy was an adult, and he was in his standard duty uniform, and, you know, had his fresh buzz cut, and he was standing in the PX. He was playing Pac-Man, and I just remember looking at him and looking at my dad, like, with an expression on my face, like, what's going on here? And my dad said to me, well, he's just about as much of a kid as you are, and kids are kids. And I was like, wait, so soldiers are just like us? How did that happen?
Yeah. Well, the you got to really blame
Pac-Man. Blame the Japanese.
Well, you got to blame Hollywood for a lot of the perception that you get, because, you know, especially things like the Sci-Fi Channel and stuff like that. It's just the representation of the military is awful. And I mean, you know, when I would bring friends of mine to certain functions, they sit there and go, hey, how come that kid didn't run away from you and call you sir at the top of his lungs? I'm like, dude, you watch too many movies.
Yeah.
I said, first of all, you don't call me sir. I said, second of all, there's no reason outside of basic training for all that yelling. I'm like, if
he's yelling, it's because something's really loud in the background and I can't freaking hear him.
Right. Right. You know, if we're talking about World War II comedies, is Charlie Chaplin's Great Dictator, is that the first one?
I think so.
I'm not even sure I would call that a comedy, though. That's...
Well, it's satire.
Yes, but it's very black.
Yeah, sure.
Well, and the other thing, too, I think, like, when you talk about comics and the war, comics during the war did not really take place in the war.
Right.
And I think that's a misconception because we live in a post-Roy Thomas world. Roy Thomas really was the guy who invented the comic about World War II that actually deals with World War II.
Yeah, well, there's a famous Superman comic, which is a one-page comic, where he jumps, because this is before he could fly, he jumps all the way to Europe, grabs Hitler, jumps to Italy, grabs Mussolini, and then goes to Geneva and turns both of them over for the world court and says, oh, war's over.
Right.
But the trouble is that then everybody woke up the next day and the war was still on.
Right. Well, and of course...
I guess they were found not guilty.
Did Superman read you guys your rights? No? Okay, you're free to go. Well, yeah, and of course, like, now DC has gone through retroactively these mental gymnastics to explain why Superman didn't put an end to World War II, right? Because given the stature that Superman has and, like, the powers that he has now that he didn't have then, but that DC has kind of retconned back all the way to World War II, you almost enter a comic equivalent of the question of evil, right? If Superman is really good, why didn't he stop it?
You know, the guy who was writing the last really fun run on Young Avengers, that's a British author, Kieran Gillen. He's doing a comic right now called Uber, which is set in World War II. And I think it's kind of a sideways way of answering that question because it has the Germans, you know, their crazy super weapons people are developing superheroes towards the end of the war. And then the Allies managed to get some, you know, espionage going on and get their own superheroes going on. And it's he does it from a very kind of, I don't know, what's that genre, speculative history?
Yeah.
Yeah, he does it really that kind of approach. And now it's Avatar, so there's, you know, a ton of blood on every page. But
excellent.
It's an interesting read. I mean, it comes across as kind of a kitschy 70s movie about superheroes in World War II. But
and of course, the invaders had it easier because none of the World War II superheroes, even like the new ones that he creates, have anywhere near the power to actually realistically put an end to the war.
Yeah, it's an interesting thing. It's always kind of bugged me how World War II kind of has this. Well, you know, here's a better way to say it. We're working on a World War II book right now for Stark City, and Steve Perrin is writing it, and he has one character who's a Vietnam veteran who comes home very disillusioned. And he goes to talk to his friend who's a mad scientist, and he wants to go fight for America during a time when he can feel good about being an American and feel like he's doing the right thing. And it's kind of a Back to the Future homage. His scientist friend, who happens to be named Doc Brown, sends him back to World War II so he can fight for America during a time he feels proud to be an American. And, I mean, it's a tip of the hat to that movie series, but the way America feels about Vietnam, even the wars going on today versus the way we feel about World War II. I mean, when you go to Washington, D.C., I mean, the Vietnam Memorial, everyone's familiar with it. It's that stark black wall with names. Now, they just recently finished World War II Memorial in the last decade, and it's like a Roman temple.
Sure. Well, look, there's a line in Mad Men that I love, early in the series Mad Men, in which you have the guy that John Sterling plays on Mad Men, who's kind of the senior executive, and he's a World War II veteran, and Don Draper, who is a Korean War veteran, and he says to the World War II veteran, he was like, well, yeah, you know, I did the same thing you did, but you guys in World War II took all the glory and didn't leave any for us. Because that's not a new phenomenon. When soldiers got back from the Korean War, everyone was like, Uh-huh. Thank you. Go about your business.
I guess that's a good point. I hadn't thought of it. I mean, Korea kind of is a forgotten war.
I think what it's about is, for the most part, every war since World War II, our existence as a nation was not really at stake. And I think you can't avoid that. You of course, we should all acknowledge individual sacrifice, but in no war since World War II has the fate of the United States been at question. Right? There was really no scenario, except perhaps nuking China.
I would add to that, you know, we haven't had a win since then, not a clear one.
But mostly because we haven't been willing to, in what are essentially wars of choice, done the things that would be required for total capitulation.
And that's true. But I'm just saying, you can't underestimate the effect on the American psyche when you don't have that parade through Berlin and Tokyo to make everybody feel like it was all worthwhile and we definitely accomplished something.
Okay, sure. But there are political climates that have to be in effect for that to happen. For example, the Tet Offensive in Vietnam was a huge victory for the United States. It was an offensive by the other side, a surprise attack, that was a complete rout. It wound up turning into...
We agree, sir, that they're very, very, very different wars. I'm just saying they're different to the American psyche because we didn't get that victory parade through Hanoi.
Sure, but I'm saying... Yeah. We couldn't have it because when you look at the response to the Tet Offensive, it was like, oh, how did we not know this was coming? Instead of focusing on the fact that actually that was an amazing American victory. So go ahead.
I'm not sure that the victory parade is a... I mean, imagine if we were to have a victory parade through Baghdad or something. It would be awful. I mean, if we had a war and had a tank parade through the streets of the conquered city, God, no president, no secretary of defense would authorize that. It would look awful. 21st century media optics would tear it apart.
Well, maybe landing a jet on the aircraft carrier with the mission accomplished banner is kind of an attempt at
that. Yeah. Oh, yeah. You're right. Yeah, that's what that was. Yeah, you're right.
Well, but again, there's also there's you can never escape the impetus of the war. You can never escape the root causes of the war. And when a war is essentially a war of choice, that changes everything. Whereas again, at the start of World War II, everyone was like, "Oh, wait," you know, Winston Churchill was transferring the British Treasury to Canada and making plans to move the Queen there to continue the fight against Germany from Canada. That is a situation that has never happened since.
It's a good point. You've got the close ties we have between, you know, England and, you know, it was very directly imperiled, you know, much like in World War I. But,
I guess what... kind of what Chuck's getting at is that World War II was sort of an existential threat.
Yes.
And the closest we've had to an existential threat since then, I guess, is the kind of drumbeat of the War on Terror. This idea that our whole way of life could be threatened. And whether or not you believe that, I've certainly heard it. Like, there are people, I have students in my classroom who believe that our way of life is threatened by radical Islam.
Wow.
That is sad.
Exactly. I can't...
This is so, you know, whether or not you know, our listeners actually believe this or not, there's a percentage of America that does, but to get back to Chuck's point, and so it's kind of like just like basic... narrative plotting. Like, if you were telling a story, you want the most intense crisis to be the end. And we got to that point, but then the story didn't end. The story kept going, and all the other crises have been sort of anticlimactic.
Well, look, we made a decision, and by we I mean really Western civilization in the Korean War, when China entered on behalf of North Korea in the Korean War, which they had warned they would do, and Churchill MacArthur dismissed them, all that good stuff. His response was, well, our goal is complete victory, and so I'm going to need 10 atomic bombs and some bombers. We're going to start dropping atomic bombs at various places in China because we have to win. And Truman and the vast majority of the political leadership in the United States were like, no. If that is what winning takes, we are no longer willing to win. We as a country are not in any danger. So barring that, what about the status quo? How about I fire you and put a guy in charge and just leave it the way you found it? How's that?
Right.
You know, so that's the thing, is that we have entered a world where A, we're primarily fighting wars of choice, and B, in many cases, complete victory would require something way too horrible to contemplate.
Well, fair enough.
Poor Mike doesn't know where to go. See, you picked like World War II, and you thought we'd all be talking about like allies or something.
I thought someone would have brought up Inglourious Bastards by now.
I think you just did.
Yeah.
You know what I think is funny is that I remember when Inglourious Bastards came out, and Brad Pitt said, "This is the World War II movie to end all World War II movies." Like,
sadly, he was wrong.
There was never we never have to have another one. And then now here he is in the multiplexes as we speak.
Well, okay, and
World War II movie.
Do people really think Inglourious Bastards, by the way, is a fun, light movie? I encountered this notion a lot where people are like, yeah, that movie was great. That movie is frightening. That is Quentin Tarantino showing you that if he ever chose to go seriously into the propaganda business, that he could topple governments at will through the power of movie making. Because this is literally a movie that has people cheering for men who scalp other men.
Yeah.
Well,
and by the way, propaganda plays a huge part in the subtext of that movie. The Germans are showing their propaganda film that they're so proud of in the course of that movie. And that is not an accident.
There's a lot of subtext there. I'll give you that. Here's the thing. Any movie where you have Hitler being machine gunned, there's something about that you kind of like on just a gut level.
Well, that's exactly what Tarantino is doing. He wants you to love it.
Yes.
And then he shows you how awful you are for loving it.
Right, and then except most people don't notice that it's like the Starship Troopers movie where most people don't notice that the human soldiers are the bad guys in the movie.
Right.
The Inglourious Basterds also has a quote unquote heroic moment where an entire movie theater full of people, some of which are evil, but the vast majority of which are really not. Many of them are clearly shown to you not to be there by choice. But that theater is set on fire and they all die and you go, yeah, that's great. She sure got back at that guy.
Yeah.
You know, that movie is terrifying. Sorry, Mike, I continue to pour cold water on your...
No, we invited you guys for the conversation, so it's all good. Did you see Fury, Chuck?
I have not. I boycott Shia LaBeouf on the fact that he's a douche and a plagiarist. So I refuse
Morning
to.
Morningstar, have you seen Fury?
Speaking of Quentin Tarantino.
Yes. Oh, plagiarist and douche.
I don't know about douche. I never met the man, between him and the scandal his girlfriend wound up in, that's not an unfair characterization.
I guess I'm not familiar with that.
His girlfriend, who goes by the name of Leanne Spiderbaby, and yes, she's an adult who goes by the name of Leanne Spiderbaby, made a name for herself writing for like throwback monster magazines and things like that, and published like 50, 60 articles, and apparently didn't write a single word of it herself. And it got pretty ugly with it within that little niche of fandom.
Are we talking about a ghostwriter that she hired, or did she just steal?
Nope, just straight ripping off other people's articles.
And of course, given the number of writers we have here, I feel pretty safe in saying that all of us think that is the worst form of heinous behavior, and people who do that sort of thing should be burned at the stake. I think that's a measured response.
It also resulted in me making the most unlikely enemy I've ever made in my life.
Which was?
Well, the one that put her over the top was she wrote an article for like the Cadillac of Monster Movie Magazine's Video Watchdog.
Okay.
When the scandal originally broke, it was somebody at a Monster Movie forum broke it, and the editor of Video Watchdog shot back with, "Well, I've hired one of my editors to finally get around to checking one of her articles for originality, and I have only found two passages lifted from this. So this is obviously about her being a woman, an attractive woman, and dating a famous guy. And you bunch of misogynists, male chauvinist pigs suck." And then when the other 50, 60 examples came back.
Yeah.
I said that, you know, I don't know. I posted on the same forum. You know, I don't know if I can continue to support a magazine that isn't bothering to vet any of their articles until months right. after the fact. And then I found out that that he had unfriended and blocked me on Facebook. And this was within like 30 minutes of me posting that.
You didn't need to be his friend anyway, obviously.
Obviously not, but I'm thinking, what kind of world does this guy live in that he's looking for people to criticize him on forums and like, "I'm going to get you, mister. I'm going to unfriend and block you." I mean, well, you're good. You're best friends with Tarantino. Go hang out with the filmmaker. Yeah. Don't worry about what Joe Gamewriter thinks of your magazine.
Hey, man, life in a foxhole, right? He was under siege.
I guess so. But I just can't believe that I register enough on his radar to qualify for any sort of revenge.
Well, you are any award-winning author, Chris McLaughlin.
Yeah, but I don't hang out with Quentin Tarantino, for better or worse.
That is true. Well, but okay, there was that famous, or I guess I should say infamous, incident where John Byrne spent like an entire Thanksgiving holiday arguing with some random poster on his board and calling him a shit stain, and then banned the guy from his board and deleted all the posts that made him look bad. You know, being talented and connected does not stop you from being insane.
Well, you guys heard about what Anne Rice did with her last Lestat book, right?
No.
Okay, well, I think it was the first one where her publisher didn't hire her an editor, and,
it's the first warning sign.
Yeah, I mean, it's not just a proofreader. I think she handles all of her grammar and spelling herself, which is fine. It's just, the content was different than previous Lestat novels, and the way she was marketing it on the, you know, was talking about it was, you know, Lestat has never spoken more directly to me than they did with this book. The thing is, all of her fans were reading the previous novels where Lestat was not speaking so fully to her, really didn't care for it. And it just really melted down in the comments and on Amazon. And she finally just said, you know, screw it. If you guys are unhappy, send me the book. Here's my address in New Orleans. I will mail you.
Oh, no.
And so people started mailing her their books.
Oh, God. Oh, no.
And she closed her Amazon account and quit replying to reviews. And apparently none of those folks got their refund. So, yeah.
There's a reason I guard my home address jealously.
Well, not only that, but it boggles my mind how many really famous authors. I mean, you're talking about Anne fucking Rice here.
Yeah.
Doesn't know that there's no upside to her to respond to a review.
Well, it's foxhole mentality, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, but there are first-time writers who know better than that. I had to make that mistake once before I learned it.
I don't think I've ever engaged anybody in a review, but I haven't written nearly as much as Chuck has.
It's never a good idea. Never. Never goes well.
My interaction with reviews is usually, thanks.
Yeah, seriously.
If there's a factual mistake, like if they actually misquote the book, then you can kind of step in and say, but in the end, reviews are for potential readers.
Oh, no, actually, I have to correct myself. Okay, I have a Roy Thomas story. This is actually applicable to this blog. Okay. Mm. All right, so I wrote a book.
Did you?
I wrote a book. It's called Superheroes of the Round Table, Comics Connections to Medieval and Renaissance Literature. It's an academic book. Don't buy it. It's expensive. I'm not here to shill my book. But it grew out of my dissertation. Okay. And I had the most fun ever. I got to write 250 pages about Shakespeare and Iron Man. I mean, come on. Okay. But I'm just sitting there doing my thing one day, and I think it was you, Mike.
What'd I do?
You emailed me and said, hey, Roy Thomas is saying bad shit about your book on Amazon.
That sounds like me.
And I said, what?
Well, you're welcome.
So I go to Amazon where my page is, and it turns out that Roy Thomas, of course, has a Yahoo group.
Of course he does.
Of course he does. And it's filled with fans of Roy Thomas. And Roy Thomas, who's an avid reader, saw my book on the shelf of some comic store, because some comic stores carried it when it first came out. And he opened it up, and he went to the index, and he looked for his name. And, you know, if I was Roy Thomas, I would probably do that shit too. So I'm not criticizing. Okay, so he looked for his name. And he found it. In the section where I talk about Jack Kirby's Fourth World, where he puts House Roy, which was Kirby's satirical portrait of Roy Thomas.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
In underneath a Funky Flashman, in the Funky Flashman stories. And that's the only part of Roy Thomas he saw. And he was like, I wrote all kinds of characters that involved King Arthur. And like Shining Knight and so on. And none of those characters are in the book. So I can't recommend this book. And of course, Thomas's loyal fans got outraged on his behalf. And they went to my Amazon page and called my book plagiarism and the worst unreferenced claptrap they've ever read and so on and so forth. None of them read a page, okay? They didn't read a fucking page. But they were defending their man, Roy Thomas. And I saw like three or four of these scathing reviews. And so I went to my friend network and I said, okay, guys, you're all the people that have actually read this book and give a damn. Will you please go onto my Amazon page and say something nice to counter these guys? That's how I engaged with the review.
Right.
Now, I did write to Roy, though. I did write to Thomas and I said, look, my book is not a survey. I was not here to talk about every King Arthur superhero ever written about, because other people have already done that. And I pointed into Michael Torregrossa's Camelot in Four Colors and all kinds of other articles and websites that do exactly what Thomas was looking for. I said, I wasn't here to do that. I was here to talk about particular characters that I had something to talk about, that I had something to say. And I didn't really have anything to say about Shining Knight, so I didn't talk about him. Or, for that matter, the Avengers Black Knight character whom Roy Thomas also wrote.
Right.
And who was not in the book. I'm like, look, this wasn't my purpose. I'm sorry. And I was deeply apologetic because I admired the hell out of Roy Thomas. And I'm so sorry you didn't like my book. And please understand that, you know, I didn't, it wasn't personal. And and he wrote back and he was a little contrite and he said, I'm sorry. And I will finish the book and I'll probably like it a lot better. And I'm sorry that I was so hard on you, and that was sort of where the story ended.
I am sorry I set my legions of internet fans upon you.
He actually never apologized for that.
Well, hey, we need to wrap up, but we got pretty far afield of World War II.
Sorry.
We were technically telling war stories, just ours.
This is true.
Sounds like we might need to do a part two of this series.
Yeah, that might be all right.
You know, what I would really do is a Vietnam episode.
Ooh.
Silence.
I'm in.
That went over like a lead balloon. Okay, never mind.
Well, no, it's just, can you guys think of a Vietnam RPG? I can't.
Yeah, there's Recon. There's, yeah. There's one where they have, I can't remember the name of it right now, but it's Zombies Breakout.
And Pinnacle did a Weird Wars Vietnam.
Phoenix Command, which is a very great, very gritty, old-school Cold War RPG.
Damn. Wow. Okay. I don't know. There have been a lot of Vietnam RPGs I didn't know about, so okay. Okay, well, hey, let's talk about that offline, see if we can get that going on. We've had a discussion this lively in a while, so it's obviously a fertile field we can come back to. Just two quick things before we sign off. I saw Fury and liked it, so if you're debating, it's still in the theaters. And I remembered a Norwegian movie I saw a while back that's worth seeing, Max Manus. It's about this Norwegian resistance fighter. Really a great movie, and you can find it on Netflix, I think, so... That's the only one check out too.
Check it out.
Yeah. Anyone have any closing thoughts before we sign off?
Yes. Everyone connected with Video Watchdog, I'm really, really, really sorry. Can I buy you a beer or something? can we talk it out? Hug it out, please.
You have no hopes that'll actually happen to you, Chris.
None at all. Okay. None at all.
Just check.
I'll say good night.
It's nice to meet you guys.
Hey, Chuck.
Yeah, nice to meet you, Jason.
Any closing words, Chuck?
No, I'm good.
All right. Okay, all right. All right. Until next time, thanks for tuning in to the Banff Podcast.